From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Anxiety disorder is pretty common. So common, we crack jokes about it.
And what can I get for you tonight?
I'll have the Brussels sprout and fried egg salad.
Excellent. And for you, sir?
I'll have the swordfish.
We actually just ran out of the swordfish. Is there something else I can get for you?
I'll find something. Steak, red meat, can't do red meat. Too much cholesterol. I'm watching that. Would you help me find something? Help me.
Today, we'll hear about a creative way that one Georgia university helps students alleviate their anxiety. And we'll talk about a deadly encounter between a mentally ill veteran and a police officer in DeKalb County. That's all coming up. First, though, let's step outside for a snack. Okay, we'll not step outside because it's kind of cold out there. But we do have some great tips on how to forage for food in Georgia. And we got them yesterday. Robbie Astrove is a master forager based in Atlanta.
In Georgia, we're very fortunate to have a varied landscape with different climate zones and whatnot. Here in Atlanta, in the urban environment, there's so many great things. There's figs, apples, pears, plums, peaches, wildflowers, berries, mushrooms.
And it turns out we have a lot of foragers among our listeners. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Jonathan Evans calling from Athens, Georgia. Back at Indiana University in Bloomington, I discovered one day trees in the student union building parking lot. It turned out they were crabapple trees, and in the middle of July, I noticed that the limbs were practically breaking with the weight of the crabapple fruit. So I returned the next day with a couple of baskets and took them home and made crabapple jelly, which my wife and I enjoyed for years after that.
I'm calling from Savannah, Georgia. My name is Mariella, and I just heard the story on urban foragers, and I actually do that. I mean, the fig trees are just everywhere, but I am embarrassed to pick any fruit that might be growing in public roads. I know that those roads belong to the city or the county, so I don't know if that's okay to do.
Hello, my name is Liz Conroy, calling from Athens, Georgia. I would just like to add that that leaving some fruit for our wildlife is crucial, and when you take all the berries from a tree or all the wild plums, our birds are starving, as well as other wildlife.
We always love to hear what you think. So call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message just like they did. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. 27-year-old Anthony Hill was naked and unarmed last March when he was fatally shot by a DeKalb County police officer. The officer is a 7-year veteran of law enforcement named James Olson. Last night, Olson was indicted on 6 counts, including felony murder. The DeKalb District Attorney says Olson is the first Georgia on-duty officer to be prosecuted for shooting a civilian in 5 years. Reporter Christian Boone has been covering this case for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he joins us now. Hi, Christian.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Can we just quickly remind people of this story? Because it has been a while since Anthony Hill died. Anthony Hill was outside and a neighbor called because of erratic behavior. What happened when Officer James Olson arrived?
Well, as best we can tell from witness testimony and just talking with people who've observed and studied the case, the officer arrived. There was only one officer, and that was Robert Olson. He spotted Anthony Hill across the courtyard of the apartments over in Chamblee. And Hill, once he saw the officer, started moving toward him, first kind of in a, you know, sort of a rapid trot, and then slowed down once he was ordered to stop. He didn't order to stop. There were two commands by Olson for him to cease, and he didn't, and that's when he was shot.
Now, we spoke with Cedric Alexander, who's the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for Public Safety in DeKalb. And one of the things that he talked about was mental health training. And I want to play this comment, because he said over the next year and a half, he's going to have all of his officers going through 40 hours of mental health training instead of 2 or 3. Take a listen.
Why is that important? Because as we continue to engage those in our community who have mental health challenges, if we can train our officers how to approach those individuals, in a much more calm way, less threatening type of way. If we can teach them some of the basic signs and symptoms they need to look for
on the street level, it might keep everybody more safe.
Reduce the likelihood of some unfortunate event taking place.
And I wanted to ask you, Christian, if one of the reasons why Robert Olson was indicted was because perhaps they felt he did not use the training he'd had in how to interact with a mentally ill individual.
Yeah, I don't. Obviously, not being in the grand jury, I don't know. I think a bigger factor may have been a false statement given, that there were essentially maybe two stories told about this. Again, I was not in the grand jury and can't say,
yeah.
But I think that may have played a big factor. But he did have 40 hours of training, according to his post records.
And he had a taser on him as well.
He did.
Which he did not deploy. Now, the false statement count actually stems because he allegedly told a fellow officer that he was physically assaulted before the shooting, and that did not occur?
There are, according to Don Samuel, who is the witness for Anthony Hill, that there, you know, or the attorney, I'm sorry, for Anthony Hill, he said there were some witnesses who saw Hill attack his client. But the witnesses called by the district attorney yesterday did not see that. They saw Hill walking toward him, but not, you know, physically assaulting the officer.
Now, there's another count of violation of oath. What is that from?
That is from just the oath of office about excessive use of force.
In the use of force policy from DeKalb. Okay.
Yes.
Now, one of the things that people have brought up, and in fact the DA even brought up, was how rare an indictment like this is against an officer in the course of his or her duties. And as I understand it, Georgia has some of the most extensive protections for officers against suits like this. How long has it been since we saw an officer indicted for killing a civilian while on duty?
Well, it's been more than 5 years since there's been one indictment within these 5 years, but that indictment was dropped the following day. So Olson will be the first officer prosecuted in more than 5 years. That spans 187 cases involving failed shootings in Georgia. And a large reason for that is that the officer has a special privilege in Georgia in which they get to testify last, and they are not challenged. There's no cross-examination. So their word, you know, essentially is the last thing the jurors hear before they go deliberate.
I want to play you two comments, Christian, and get your reaction. The first is Timothy Lynch of the Cato Institute, and he's talking about just how much power a prosecutor has over whether someone is indicted.
If they want an indictment, they're going to get an indictment. If they don't want an indictment, it won't happen. Prosecutors are often unwilling to take on members of the police department because they work with the police week in and week out.
Now, when I asked Cedric Alexander of DeKalb County Police about that, he says he does think that district attorneys get a bad rap when it comes to police shooting investigations, but he also said this.
But we also have to be clear that you have DAs out there who are very reputable, very credible, very honest, and very matter of fact, regardless of who the individuals are that's involved in the shooting. Even in a police shooting, they're going to be very transparent. They're going to be open, and they don't have a problem indicting other law enforcement officials.
So, Christian, what do we know about the DeKalb district attorney who brought forward these indictments?
Well, they had 8 hours of evidence yesterday and testimony, and I think it was very clear that he was going for, you know, he had, his heart was in this. I think, you know, the argument is on many of these cases, as your the comment you just played, is they don't really want to get a prosecution because it just creates a lot of problems, because obviously the district attorney has to work with the police on all their cases pretty much. So, but this case, I believe there was a little doubt that Robert James wanted this indictment badly, and he got it on all counts.
What happens next? What's the timeline for this kind of case?
Well, there'll be a first appearance we expect today, and I think it'll move pretty fast. I don't think we'll see any kind of like one or, you know, 1.5 year delay between the indictment and the trial. So I would expect that we will have something, a trial sometime this year.
And just to be clear, there is another lawsuit, which is a civil wrongful death lawsuit against both Officer Olson and DeKalb County. That's completely separate from these indictments the DA has announced, correct?
It is. It's filed by the family and their attorney, the Anthony Hill's family and their attorney.
And we have any timeline on that?
We do not. I mean, generally, I think it would follow the criminal trial. Not always, but I think that the criminal trial will probably come first, and then whatever civil action would follow that.
Now, Christian, you've been following this for a while, and I wonder. I mean, obviously, there's a racial component. Any time a white officer kills an unarmed black man, but especially in DeKalb County, where 55% of the residents are African American, I wonder what your sense is on whether these indictments will make progress towards healing some of the wounds in that community. I mean, according to many of the people that you've spoken with, or it's going to have to rest on whether or not there's an actual conviction.
You know, I think it'll go. It'll make some difference. I mean, the reaction yesterday from the protesters or last evening outside the courthouse was almost jubilation that the indictment was brought. Obviously, you know, they're going to want to see a prosecution and a successful prosecution. But, you know, considering where we've been in Georgia, where there hasn't been, you know, an indictment brought in almost 6 years, you know, one step at a time, I guess. I mean, I think people are sort of savoring what you know, who believe there should have been an indictment brought, are sort of savoring, you know, that little piece of news from last night.
And I wonder, let me play you one more comment from Cedric Alexander of the DeKalb County Police. And see, he's talking here about having the Georgia Bureau of Investigations, the GBI, overtake the review of police shootings.
People want to feel a sense of transparency and fairness being done. Part of police reform that's very important to me, I truly believe that in police-involved shootings, particularly those that in deadly force, that they should be investigated by an outside entity. I truly support that.
And do we have any sense, Christian, that the GBI made a difference in this particular investigation and whether or not it led to indictments?
Well, I mean, previous to this case, DeKalb had handled their own internal investigations. We don't know, you know, what impact that may have had that DeKalb, that the GBI took this over. I know Cedric Alexander's on the 21st Century Policing Task Force, which was one of the recommendations is that a separate entity come in and investigate, not be internal. And now, of course, one of the issues is that the GBI is very overtaxed with this because they've taken on DeKalb, Gwinnett in the past year, and just the other day they've agreed to take on all investigations of Atlanta police shootings. So they're trying to get funding for 20 additional agents who would specialize and who would focus on these type of cases.
Well, thank you very much. That is Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Christian Boone. I appreciate it, Christian.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Anxiety and depression are on the rise for college students. A recent report from the American College Health Association found nearly 1 in 6 students has been diagnosed with or treated for anxiety in the past year. Campus counseling centers around the country have come up with creative solutions to deal with the high demand for their services. Emory University recently hired its first full-time therapy dog to help students de-stress. Producer Linda Chan recently stopped by to see the dog at work, and she brings us this audio postcard.
Hi there, good girl. Good girl, say hi.
My name is Colleen Duffy, and I'm a senior staff psychologist with Emory University's Counseling and Psychological Service. And I am the handler of our therapy dog in training, Beowulf.
Such a good girl.
Wow, she's big. I had no idea she was so big.
Such a good girl.
Beowulf is a Native American Indian dog, and they're pretty rare. There aren't that many of these dogs. She's 10 months old right now, and she will grow to maybe between 85 and 100 pounds, so she's a big girl.
Yeah. She's about to go to work. We're doing an outreach at the computer center.
Can
so
I
she'll
pet
be there
her?
For you? Yes, you can.
A well-trained therapy dog is very attuned to emotions of humans. She's very calm, and so if clients are coming in who are very anxious or have been traumatized or even maybe depressed interpersonally, they've had traumas interpersonally, then having a dog that they can connect with and pet can be incredibly soothing, and it can bridge a therapeutic relationship.
Hi, puppy. Good girl. You giving some loves? You giving some licks?
For some people, white traditional talk therapy is great and fabulous and wonderful, and for others, there can be some bridging that also happens.
You will always love me no matter what I get on my biology exam. Look at that smile.
It brings me joy. I mean, just how much happiness she's bringing people right now. You know, it's high stress, very competitive, rigorous, academic curriculums here, and she's giving them a moment where they can just be kids for a bit. You know, young adults, but also a little bit of freedom from studying. And like this young woman said, Beowulf doesn't care about my biology test. How she does.
There we go. Oh, good girl. Give some nice belly rubs.
We're just trying to be innovative and creative. I'm from New Zealand, and so, you know, I am very, or hope to be, just very, you know, culturally humble with what's going to work in a pragmatic way, what works for multiple people, and how do we be innovative. And I think a therapy dog is an innovative way to just say, let's see what works.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good girl.
To learn more about Emory's first therapy dog and other services offered by Emory's Counseling and Psychological Services, visit studenthealth.emory.edu. While we're on the topic of dogs, if your pet is not microchipped, this next story might convince you to go get that done. Amanda Benton lives in Arlington, Texas. Last September, Amanda was packing her house for a move, and somehow her tiny chihuahua escaped from the backyard. She looked for the dog for weeks and thought he was gone forever. 5 months later, she gets a call from the Humane Society saying they found her dog and she can come pick him up. Benton was ready to jump into the car until they told her that her 5-pound chihuahua was in Atlanta. The only reason they knew where Coco belonged was the tiny microchip implant. The journey from Arlington, Texas to Atlanta is more than 800 miles, by the way, and that's only if Coco walked in a straight line. The Atlanta Humane Society even paid for Amanda's flight so she could come to Georgia to collect her dog.
If he could talk, I would just would love to hear his story. I mean, this is just crazy.
So, if you have not microchipped your pet yet, think of Coco the Chihuahua and consider it. It only costs about $25 plus the cost of airfare to wherever your dog ends up. Hopefully, not Texas. It's been a long week, and hopefully wherever you are safe from the weather. We have talked about everything this week, from the future of soccer in Georgia to the new PSAT tests. And we heard a story from a man who spent 10 years as a paramedic in Atlanta. So let's unwind a little, shall we? We've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, relax, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for The Break Room.
A lawmaker in South Carolina is now proposing that journalists in his state register with the government before doing their jobs.
Will Smith's TV aunt has kind of declared war on his real-life wife, Jada Pinkett Smith.
A children's picture book that depicts happy slaves is being pulled from the shelves only weeks after its release.
Joining us in the break room this week, Hector Fernandez teaches in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University, so he is cultured. Greg Williams, host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. Tanya Washington, law professor at Georgia State University. And we have a newcomer, a rookie, Amy Condon, joins us remotely. She's the associate editor for Savannah Magazine. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Welcome to everyone.
Morning.
Thanks, Celeste.
Morning.
I didn't mean to imply that the rest of you were not cultured. I just mean that it's part of Hector's title.
What does that mean?
Not sure. It's your title, buddy. Let's start with Kroger. There's a certain store in Atlanta. It has a very unfortunate reputation and an equally unfortunate nickname, Murder Kroger. The store is located in the Ponce Highland neighborhood of East Atlanta. It's right next to the Beltline. And Murder Kroger earned that name because of a couple murders that took place there, and then there was a body found in the store's parking lot. This week, we found out Kroger will be demolished and remodeled as part of a mixed-use development there. The project's set to begin this year and then will open in 2018. So let's start with first whether you think a store can be cursed. Is that a thing?
It's not really the store being cursed. It was the location, which was always kind of a location. That,
well, you're in real estate, aren't you?
Yeah. As the day job. The radio show is more of a hobby. But the location in that area, it's now going through gentrification. But it was always a little bit in transition, I guess would be the PC term for it. But, just when they were getting over the first murder, it was 20 years ago in the early 90s, Kroger was trying to call it the Beltline Kroger. And then another murder happened about 6 months ago. And, it's just bad luck, but also the location.
Amy, would you go to this Kroger?
I might take some white sage and smudge it first.
She's trying to cleanse the area.
I live in Savannah, so we're used to spirits. So I might bring that and sort of bless the place and invite all the bad juju to go and make peace with something.
Hector?
Well, while respecting the spirits, it's not the spirits who do the things. It's humans. I don't shop at Kroger anyway, so, I would never go there.
You would doubly not go there because you don't like Kroger as a store, and then it's the Murder Kroger, so no.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely no. You're right.
And I have shopped at that Kroger and did not know until preparing for this segment that it was the Murder Kroger.
You didn't know? Really? There's even songs written about it.
It's not on the coupons when you go
in? Yeah, it doesn't say, Kroger murder in parentheses. So, yeah, I would continue to shop there. I shop at Kroger because you get the points and then you get the lower gas.
And because it's cheaper than Publix and certainly Whole Foods.
I get the gas and I never shop at
you
Kroger.
You want to spend $10 on milk,
but you don't
go to Whole Foods.
Get the discount.
No, I do get the discount. I get
Okay, now
discounts.
We've devolved into a discussion of which grocery store is the
Clark
best.
Clark Howard would be so proud of this conversation.
Let's bring us back on topic. There is another issue that's really distracted people this week, and that's the Oscars. No person of color was nominated for any of the four acting categories. That is not the first time that has happened, of course. And so the hashtag that used to be Oscars So White has been resurrected. It's now Oscars Still So White. Some actors say they will boycott this year's ceremony, and that includes people like Spike Lee and also actress Jada Pinkett Smith. Here she is in her video that announced her decision.
Have we now come to a new time and place where we recognize that we can no longer beg for the love, acknowledgement, or respect of any group?
Now, her husband, Will Smith, he starred in the movie Concussion, has also confirmed that he will not be attending, and her decision was not met with joy by everyone. Janet Hubert, who used to be Will Smith's co-star in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, blasted the actress in her video response.
I find it ironic that somebody who has made their living and made millions and millions of dollars from the very people that you're talking about boycotting, just because you didn't get a nomination, just because you didn't win. That is not the way life works, baby.
Now, Jada Pinkett Smith has also responded to that video. I assume this is going to go on for a while. And there's another hashtag, Jada v. Janet.
It really sounded like both of them are trying out for Oscars in their responses. So perhaps they're going to be nominated next year.
Well, Janet is not going to get any cinematography nomination because I don't know what was wrong with her camera. That was bad quality.
Was it like the Blair Witch Project or something?
Lighting. Yeah, absolutely. I agree, Amy. She had her kitchen lights behind her. Amy, do you take a position here?
Fluorescence.
Amy?
Oh, pardon?
Do you take a position here?
I kind of believe that there's racism and sexism and ageism in film, and a lot of that goes back to who's making them, who's making the decisions, and the money. And so even at the academy level, they've recognized that they need to make changes on membership and how they vote. So I think if this can be a consciousness raising, and I think Chris Rock is in a perfect position to do that.
Yeah, and he actually has spoken. Yeah, he's spoken out on this. Do any of us think Chris Rock is going to say something on stage?
Everything.
Maybe. Oh yeah. there's about the same chance as there's going to be a snowstorm in D.C. this weekend.
Exactly.
So, yeah,
I just hope he's clever about it.
He's always clever.
He is. Yeah, he is.
But I mean, even more pointed.
Well, they can't exactly come out with a hook and remove him.
You can't do the gong, the gong show, you know, Showtime at the Apollo, hook him out.
You know, the hook can be, you know, what his marketability is going forward, right? You know,
right.
You kind of mess up in this space and then you don't get any more.
Will Smith
back.
Owns his own production company, as does Chris Rock. And maybe
his
friends
will help.
I'd love him to bring out Steve Harvey for a little bit. That would be awesome.
they'll be fine.
I do want to say this. I understand Janet questioning, you know, Jada's motives on the point, but I think Jada makes an important point. But my question is, why do we expect the Oscars to be anything other than what it's been historically? Right.
Can't we expect change?
Because television has already changed. It's only appropriate that film also changes.
But here's the thing. Do we boycott the Oscars or do we boycott the films? Boycotting the Oscars doesn't change anything. Boycotting the films affects people's bottom line, and people change policy when it affects their money.
I totally see the light.
I want to actually read a couple tweets about our previous discussion on Murder Kroger, and just a reminder that everyone listening can always weigh in with the break room. We were talking about that, and Todd Ream tweets, in college pre-murders, we called it the scary Kroger, and GPB's own Ricky Bevington says, last night someone called the new development Murder Tower, so I don't think locals are going to let it go.
All right.
Okay, so let's talk about possibly another location that has an undeserved, unfortunate reputation.
Claremont Lounge, maybe?
No, Waffle House.
Waffle House.
Here's what the headline read. Naked woman goes on rampage at Georgia Waffle House. So here's what happened. Investigators say a Marietta woman stripped and then attacked customers in a Waffle House late last week. She's facing charges. She tore off her clothes, threw plates at people, and then punched a customer in the face. Police had to use a stun gun to bring her down. As we know, Waffle House is not really a stranger to criminal and unsavory behavior. So anyone seen anything weird at a Waffle House? Let's go there first.
I guess they call that scattered, smothered, and uncovered.
You're referring to the hash browns. I'm sure.
Was this a white woman?
Yes. It was
who
thought that her chances of having, you know, effectively attacking someone would be better if she were naked than clothed.
I think that's a viable argument. I think that's a viable argument. I mean,
it's easier to clean if you get blood on you.
You're distracted.
I live in the place where Waffle House supposedly started, and the other day there was an armed robbery at the local Waffle House. At least the original location. If I were the owner of Waffle House, I would be deeply concerned about this. This sets a pattern, you know.
Mm-hmm. I wonder.
Kid Rock got in a trouble there a few years ago.
He gets in trouble everywhere. Look. I wonder why this happens at Waffle House.
Thank God he wasn't naked.
He's been that too publicly. So let's talk about why it happens at Waffle House. And I read a theory that it's like the same as 7-Eleven because there's Waffle Houses everywhere and they're open all the time. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think the hours have a lot to do with it.
Yeah. Nothing good happens after 2 a.m.
I think it's 9:30, Amy.
I was going to say, I thought it was midnight.
Should they put breathalyzers in the door so when the drunks walk in, they're like, no, you're 0.25, you can't come in.
But, that's who they market
cater
to, right?
Yeah, you come into Waffle House to get your coffee and sober up, right?
But traditionally, if you arrive to establishment at that point of the night, you want to pay a place that is, you know, calm, tranquil, you know, an easygoing place. And what happens is a bunch of weirdos have decided that Waffle House is the joint to raise hell.
So we need
armed
guards.
Weirdos?
Armed guards at the Waffle House. After midnight.
You, a constitutional law professor, want to put armed guards in the Waffle House.
Hey, it's keeping people safe while they eat their waffles.
Haven't you noticed that Waffle House is...
You need a weapon to assure you can consume a waffle.
What'd you say, Amy?
I was just saying, they're always so cold. I can't imagine taking my clothes off in a Waffle House. They're
now
freezing.
That's a fair point.
Have you seen a picture of this lady?
Yes. No.
She's scary.
Is she like a wildebeest or something?
Pretty close.
It's possible there are alleged issues there. Okay. It's Friday. We're in the break room. I've got Hector Fernandez with me, professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Georgia State University. Greg Williams, host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. Tanya Washington, who teaches law at Georgia State. And Amy Condon joins us remotely. She's the associate editor for Savannah Magazine. And mentioned, since we spoke of Savannah, we want to say special thank you to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning.
thank you
for that.
Yeah.
They're online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, so it turns out Georgians aren't really very good at managing money. A new report from the website creditcards.com found the average credit score here is 15 points lower than it should be if you base it on our median income here. Mm-hmm. And the average credit card debt in Atlanta, at least, is $7,000, which is relatively high. So why? Why are we not good with our finances?
Well, Atlanta, we were talking before the show, but Atlanta, more than 50% of the population is not native. So, you know, we're importing.
Oh, you're saying it's not our fault.
We're importing the bad credit.
You're bringing in people like me who don't know how to handle money. I hear where this is going.
No, it's simply because our income is so low. Incomes in Georgia are bad. We're in the lower half of the nation when it comes to income. Mm-hmm. So people don't have that much money. The cost of living in Atlanta has risen. I mean, something's got to give. So what do people use? Plastic.
Yeah. And we like nice things.
Amy, you were talking about income also.
Yeah. If income's 7% lower than the national average, and I believe Atlanta has a relatively young median age, like 33. Mm-hmm. So if you've got flat pay, higher cost of living, school debt, you're going to rely more on credit.
Yeah, we have the number one highest average amount of school debt of any state in the country.
There you go. Oh,
that's bad.
And I mean, younger people are graduating with more debt than people did even 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
And then people are changing careers and going back to school.
Yeah.
So they're incurring debt to change careers to be more marketable.
And they're also studying things that are obsolete, ancient Sumerian poetry. You know, they get out and they can't.
There's a degree in ancient Sumerian poetry?
I believe there is.
It shocks me.
At Barry.
I think Tanya's giving you the side eye.
I was an English major with a poetry emphasis, and my poetry emphasis has served me well.
Okay.
Very
was
poetic.
It ancient and Sumerian?
No.
That's a little redundant.
General poetry.
I guess I don't need to do both. Ancient and Sumerian is redundant.
Nah, our students are flocking towards film. Film is the answer of the future.
Yeah. All right, since we're talking about education, let's move on
to... But they can't get an Oscar.
Or even nominated.
Right. All right, let's move to Walton High School, which is in Cobb County. That school has asked students to buy iPads. Parents are not happy about it. They think their children are going to be left behind if they can't afford to purchase an iPad. But school officials say there will be iPads available for checkout if students don't have one, but they can't bring the iPads home. Mm-hmm. Parents say that's not enough. They think their students might struggle or they might be at a disadvantage with the kids who do have an iPad then, since they're planning to put instruction on these iPads. Mm-hmm. And the teachers have said they plan to use the iPads for both assignments and for activities. So what do we think here? Is this fair to start moving to tablets and ask students to... You're already nodding.
Yep. Well, I mean, I went to the feeder middle school called Dodgen for Walton, and I can assure you everybody there can afford an iPad. I mean, it's the wealthiest school district probably in the state of Georgia. It's the number one school public-wise. Everybody wants to move into the Walton district in Cobb County. And I think that eventually iPads are going to replace their traditional textbooks, and that can save a lot of money and be more convenient for students.
That's what every administration at an educational institution thinks. That's going to save a lot of money. I hope it does, because otherwise it's going to be the Georgia way. They're going to use the plastic because they need the tablets. They're going to need the equipment because this is about the digital divide.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you can't deal with technology, you're going to be left out in the future.
But an iPad costs like $350.
Yeah. Plastic.
Are they offering any sort of student breaks? I couldn't find anything on that.
They are not. It doesn't. Okay. Not that I have been able to find.
So and if anyone knows any different, consumer, let me
know. Yeah,
I'm not like concerned. I'm not concerned about people in affluent districts. I'm concerned about when it becomes the norm, and you have schools that are in neighborhoods that are not that well off, and they're still going to be expected to use technology.
Exactly. And Hector spoke about the digital divide. It's widening. And unless we do something to kind of close the gap, you're going to have people who are not able to use this technology. And now all of the homework, most of the assignments require the use of the computer. And if you can't take it home, you can't do your homework.
Yeah, it's true. Let's move on to a law that has been proposed in South Carolina, and this has made a few waves. A lawmaker there in South Carolina filed a bill earlier this week, and it would create a registry for, quote, responsible journalists, unquote.
Journalists who agree with government policies.
I'm assuming that does not include Sean Penn. The bill requires...
Is he a journalist?
He said he is.
Oh, okay.
Because he interviewed El Chapo.
Makes you a journalist.
The bill requires journalists to submit to a background check and then provide a statement from an approved media outlet that attests to the person's, quote, journalistic competence, unquote. It even stated there will be criminal penalties if any of these rules are violated. Now, listen, there is no chance this bill is going to pass. Zero. But Representative Mike Pitt says it's not the point. He wrote on Facebook that he filed the bill as a, quote, experiment to make a point about the media, end quote. Here actually is Pitts in an interview on a local radio program.
The first two reporters that asked for an interview on this had not even read the bill. They had only read the title.
I would like to say that most of the legislators don't read the bills.
Exactly. Exactly.
First thought.
Really?
Hector, you wanted to jump
in. No, this is draconian. I mean, as for the spirit, the thing I wanted to point out is I think it's mildly ironic that a party that constantly complains about too much government is constantly coming up with new ways to shove government right down your throat. I mean, so that's contradictory, to say the least. I would say, to me, it's hypocritical.
Yeah, I was about to say Kim Jong Un has a really good Southern accent. You know, we were listening to that.
Oh boy, Mike Pitts, you can send your complaints to CraigslistLive.com.
Is he a Republican? I mean, I guess since the assumption was that he's Republican,
yes.
But I didn't.
He is in fact
it says
a Republican.
It in the article.
Well, we're kicking him out. He's a rhino.
Amy, what do you think about this?
Well, I wanted to find a definition for responsible journalists.
Yes.
And I thought it was interesting that there was sort of this equation between the pen and guns in some of the conversations around this, that they were trying to heighten all
the security
media issues around gun control. Mm. And so shouldn't the First Amendment be held to more scrutiny as well? And I was just like, I don't see how you make that leap.
Well, the First Amendment doesn't require that what you say makes sense.
Right.
It just it just protects the right to speak. And in fact,
content,
and you're not supposed to limit content. Like, that's kind of the essence of the First Amendment.
Hence Sarah Palin.
Yeah. You just get to say it.
There's also constitutional law that says you can't run into a building and yell fire.
Exactly. Where it puts people in danger.
Yeah, I mean, again, this bill is not expected to pass. I will say that journalists are expected to register if we want to get a credential that allows us to go into place.
Yeah, but that's different.
Yeah, and a press pass.
And I think that there are norms of professional ethics that govern journalists, just like they govern any other professional.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'd like those laws. Yeah, I'd like responsible legislators.
I mean, anybody,
right? We should have that as a requirement as well.
Drug test the legislators. That's what we need to do. Well, I mean, anybody with a blog now can be a. We do have a new era of citizen journalism, which mm-hmm. is kind of what I consider myself. And I don't think we should have to check in. I mean, if you're an idiot, it's going to be. It's going to manifest pretty quickly, right?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, we're hanging out in the break room. You just heard Greg Williams of the show Greg's List, also Tanya Washington of Georgia State University, and Hector Fernandez of the same school, and Amy Condon joins us from Savannah Magazine. Okay, maybe we should be talking about responsible authors. Scholastic recently pulled one of its children's books off shelves. There was a flood of controversy over the book titled A Birthday Cake for George Washington. The book tells the stories a story of Hercules. Hercules was a real person, a slave, and the first chef at the White House. The book shows Hercules and his daughter very happy, smiling, and taking pride as they prepare a cake for the president's birthday. There was a lot of backlash, obviously. And in the artist's notes to the author states this, quote, "While slavery in America was a vast injustice, my research indicates Hercules, the White House chef, and the other servants in George Washington's kitchen took great pride in their ability to cook for a man of such stature. That's why I've depicted them as happy people." End quote. So what do we think here? Is this whitewashing of history?
I mean, happy slave is an oxymoron. Like, I just don't understand the concept of a happy slave. You are someone's property. And so given kind of the whitewashing of the curriculum, generally, to introduce children to slavery, you know, through a smiley face and a happy story, to me is just, it's distorting and it's disgusting.
And I just wonder about authorial intent. If you were trying to show people taking pride in their work, you could have used modern examples. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to do a story on Hercules, you had an obligation to be true to his story. And now, I
should say that at least the illustrator was African American and mm-hmm. the author is mixed race. So we're mm-hmm. not talking about a Caucasian.
Yeah, it goes back to intent, though, and what you were trying to do, and did what you were trying to do, deviate
was
from
this the best way to
what's
do that?
The real story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Hector, you want to weigh in?
I think, well, the book is wrong for one, but what I have a problem with is this tendency we have to, sort of ameliorate things to just shelter and protect the kids and patronize right. them as readers. If we keep on doing that to history, kids are tough. Kid can take it. I mean, you can tell kids, slaves, they went through hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why, I get my students in college all the way university level, and they're so sheltered they can't really deal with anything.
Right. Well, I mean,
the better story would have been talking about is resilience.
Or, I think reading something like the first few chapters of Roots by Alex Haley, mm-hmm. I think that would be a very interesting juxtaposition instead of the, and I do question the guy's sources from 200 years ago that Hercules was happy.
It was female. But
he
right.
heard,
oh,
yeah.
Oh,
right.
Sorry.
She heard he was
oh,
happy.
She, okay, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about maybe a happier place. You may not need to travel very far if you're planning on a restful vacation. The number one most popular property on the online home rental site Airbnb is here in Atlanta, and it is a treehouse. The treehouse consists of three separate rooms. All are connected by rope bridges. The bathroom is located in the basement of the owner's house. It costs
That's too far. I'm sorry. In the middle of the night, no.
You get a plastic cup to stay there.
I like how
that makes it even
better. That's Amy's first concern. It costs $350 per night to stay there. And I should say, this Airbnb treehouse is featured in GBB's special about the most romantic places in Georgia. It'll air sometime around Valentine's Day and produced by GBB's own Sharon Collins, in case you want more information about the treehouse. We already heard Amy won't go there because of the bathroom accommodations. Anybody
Sorry.
Else?
Yeah. Well,
it's an obstacle course. Like, when I want to relax, I want to be in a luxurious environment. I don't want to have to take a rope to get to the kitchen.
That
so
is
you're not a camper.
Joie.
It is. I accept it.
This is redeeming. This is redeeming. The fact people are willing to pay a lot of money for a place that, has a certain degree of contact with nature. This is not some ritzy, overpriced suite or bungalow in the middle of God knows where. I mean, this the appeal is
contact with nature. So I find it worthwhile.
I'm concerned about the bugs.
You're in Georgia.
Exactly. And they would have free access.
Then don't come to my house.
Amy's in Savannah. She lives with bugs.
Big ones. But I try to carry it.
They're thinking about Airbnb is under a lot of scrutiny from the hotel motel lobby that was $5 per night tax was foisted upon them at the last minute in last year's legislative session. And our bureaucrats are doing their diligence this year to try to add Airbnb to the regulated environment. So I think that if this treehouse, you know, you may end up having to pay an extra $5 and no bedpans included. So it's very...
Leave it to Greg to bring taxes into the discussion.
Hey, push comes to shove, you can just come to the edge of the construction and, you know, there's nature there.
But wait, I begin to suspect all of you. Tani, do you not camp then?
No, there are bugs there too.
My God. Have you ever stayed at a hostel?
Yeah.
Once.
Yep.
Once.
And it was a cautionary tale.
Tanya is too highbrow for you and your hostels, Hector. Yeah.
There are certain countries I won't go to where they have spider fights.
Oh, God.
Any spiders big enough to fight,
you're excluding,
I don't need to be there.
You know, a big chunk of the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Including South America.
I'll just never see it.
Tarantulas.
She's totally okay with that. Amy, do you camp?
I haven't in a while. I used to camp quite a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you're in Savannah. You're probably okay with bugs.
And I grew up in Texas, and we would go out to the lake and stuff like that. But I've grown.
Yeah, I don't know why anybody would leave a perfectly good room to go outside. And there's no flat screen. There's no cable. No Wi-Fi when you're out there.
That's not what you went there for.
We have to have some listeners come in and support because, come on, someone's gotta love camping and getting out there and doesn't mind the bugs like me.
The truth.
New research found that we're all living with like 600 different species of insects and spiders in our homes.
Oh, no.
Most likely.
Just that so you awful. Know. that's all the time we have. This is The Break Room. We've been speaking with Hector Fernandez of Georgia State University, Greg Williams of the show Greg's List, Tanya Washington, also of Georgia State, and Amy Condon is the associate editor for Savannah Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Enjoyed the time here.
Me too. That's our show for today and the week. As always, we love to hear from you, not just about bugs, but Georgia's voters are reporting a certain amount of anxiety over the upcoming presidential election, and we wonder how you think. Do you know who you're voting for? Are there specific issues that you think are important? How would you describe your mood this election year? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, stay safe, stay warm. It's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.